You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Did you know that over 80% of companies in America, each generating more than $100 million in revenue, don't show up on public stock exchanges? They're private and are largely not an option for 401k investors. But now there's a chance for everyday American savers to opt in for access through the 401k plan if they choose to. Regardless of how you're building for the future, you deserve the same opportunities because you've earned the right to more. Learn more by visiting retiresafer.org. Paid for by the Council for a Safe and Secure Retirement.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown.
Recipe for murder, the poisonous truth behind Australia's mushroom murderer. We all saw this. This was international, global news, of course. The family and friends of Erin Patterson sat down for a lunch in Leongatha, a small town in rural Australia. Beef Wellington was on the menu. What happened next, of course, became a notorious case, and Duncan McNabb has written a book that describes this and looks at this in forensic detail. I'm delighted to say that Duncan joins me live on the line, probably from the other side of the world. Duncan, a good morning from us. Where are you, Duncan?
I got into London on Sunday, so I'm here for a couple of days and then back. Little slow trip back to Australia, but in beautiful, frigid London.
Beautiful, frigid London. Now, for those who don't know your backstory, why are you so eminently qualified to take a look at this case that was absolute worldwide news?
Yeah, back in the dark ages, I was a detective in the New South Wales Police Force. That was in the mid-80s. I got out of there in a hurry and went across to the reputable profession of media, and I've been making TV and writing books ever since. This is book number 13.
Lucky for some, as the saying goes, yeah.
Yeah, and I've spent half my life sitting in courtrooms listening to these things. So, and this case just grabbed me from day one. It grabbed me actually when it was a mystery before it turned into a murder, because it was just such a bizarre set of circumstances. Four people raced to hospital in a small country town, all after eating beef Wellington. Compelling story. And, you know, this is in July 2023. And as the month rolled past and the investigation kicked in, we saw all sorts of bizarre things. And then finally, Erin Patterson was arrested for three counts of murder and one count of attempted murder from arising from that beef Wellington lunch. So this is in November she got arrested. So I've been sort of watching it as it turned from a mystery into a murder. So it's an extraordinary story. I've been covering cases for a lot of years. Never seen one quite like this.
Because this made news as a, you know, an unfortunate lunchtime accident before the police, you know, before it was suddenly revealed that, you know, there was a suspect in this case. So it was like, you know, oh, go to Australia, everything will kill you, even, you know, everything's trying to kill you, even the beef Wellington.
Yeah, it would seem we've added beef Wellington to the list of things you probably, well, not that you wouldn't avoid it these days, but that one, yeah. We've got a lot of strange things happening in Australia over the years, but this is one of the weirdest murder cases I've ever seen, and that goes around the world for me. I've covered cases all around the joint. Just this bizarre story.
So, I mean, the original thing is, okay, this is a tragic case of food poisoning. I mean, maybe the thing was left out too long. What's the backstory of the people themselves then? Is this a happy family meal? I mean,
The people who were targeted that day at lunch, and Erin planned to kill four people that day, one Ian Wilkinson, was just pure luck to survive, and that's what it comes down to. They were her in-laws, Gail and Don Patterson, her parents-in-law. She professed and continued to profess how much she loved them, how important they were to her life. how important they were to her kids, the great-grandparents. Just really terrific, solid, good country people, worked hard all their lives, looked after their community, loved their families, all that sort of stuff. And she decided to kill them. And it was her parents-in-law, Don and Gail, plus Gail's sister, Heather, with the and her husband, Ian Wilkinson, who was a local Baptist pastor. Just, you know, really decent, respectable people.
I mean, this is rural Australia. This isn't the flesh pots of Sydney, is it? I mean, this is like you say, decent. Is this a case of this sort of thing never happens here, Duncan?
Yeah, it's to get something like this happening, well, it's mass murder. And that's, by definition, it's mass murder. They're very rare, fortunately. And in family circumstances like this, even rarer. Mass murder normally applies, especially in the media all the time, to incidents in, you know, shopping malls in the US and schools and that sort of stuff. But this is murder over a lunch table. And the thing that gets me about this case, when we realized it was a murder, is Erin Patterson sat them down and fed them and knew what was going to happen to them. And that's the absolutely horrific part of this case. She intended to murder four decent people, but she sat there and watched while they ate. And it wasn't until the trial that we actually heard this evidence and could report on it. Some preliminary hearings, we got a good taste of what was happening in the case, but we couldn't discuss any of it until it became a matter in open court. So, and it's a bizarre story. And again, a trial held in a country town, which is not common in Australia. Normally, as in the UK or anywhere else in Europe, for that matter, I suppose, large trials are scooped up and held in the city.
Yeah.
But Erin wanted her case heard to be judged by her local peers. So it happened in an old coal mining town of Morwell in Victoria. So the world media suddenly descended on a pretty quiet town. So that in itself, just watching the media circus every morning, 40-odd journos, camera crews, radios, podcasters from the UK, Daily Mail sent out a team, for example, all queuing to get into this one courtroom, plus the onlookers. You know, you go to court, normally in the first couple of days there, you know, half a dozen people come in to look around and see what's happening. But in this case, day one and the last day of the trial, there were crowds trying to get in. It was one of the biggest tickets around. So extraordinary interest globally.
I mean, what's the original story then? I just picked some. I went and got some organically sourced mushrooms, and it dealt. And then this has been a terrible accident. I mean, how do they think she could cover this story up, Duncan?
Yeah, I think she planned it quite meticulously, I think. And she's a true crime fan. She listens to podcasts and always earbuds in listening to true crime podcasts. She had around about 400 books in her library, obsessed by TV shows with crime and those TV shows that depict life behind bars as well. This is going through her head. She just literally planted. We believe that she foraged for the mushrooms. She knew where to find them. She then dehydrated them and combined them into the beef Wellington. It was quite meticulous in her planning. What she didn't plan was people thinking, hang on, this smells bad. And like a lot of crooks, they meticulously plan the crime, but they don't actually plan the exit. So Erin got out fairly early saying, this is a terrible accident. And she tried to set the narrative. And she tried to set the narrative went all the way through the trial when she actually gave evidence. And she was the only defense witness. And she set the narrative in the trial saying it was just a terrible, terrible accident. The jury of 12 people didn't believe her, and that's why they convicted her. It took 6 days of deliberations, but it was very concise.
I mean, when you say, I mean, is there sort of, has a web browser got what sort of mushrooms will kill quickly? I mean, there's normally something really, really sort of stupid, isn't it, with these cases?
They had all sorts of searches that she'd done, and there's a website, for example, we know she accessed at least one time, that is an iNaturalist website, which global website will actually take you to where you might find what you're looking for in nature. So if I happen to spot a pretty plant in the garden, I photograph it, I can whack it onto iNaturalist, and everyone can say, oh, well, there it is, and they can go and visit. Likewise, we heard evidence of phone towers. You know, your cell phone is these days, one of the great forensic tools police have is your phone tower evidence. So they found that her phone had passed by an area which had a reputation for growing these death cap mushrooms, which are prevalent in the UK. Yeah. And in parts of Australia where they could be found. So we can't prove that she actually acted on that, but the jury made a reasonable assumption she got them from somewhere.
What's the motive? Is it just she doesn't like people, or they like the family, or is it going to be a windfall? I mean, was she planning to retire to, I don't know, Hobart or something? Well, I mean,
motive still remains elusive in this, and it's just one of those things that, see, you get so frustrated with some crooks that they will actually tell you why they did it, or on deathbed confessions, which never happen, of course, by the way. But Erin, no motive became clear at all. Erin still resists the fact that it was anything else other than a horrible accident. If you're hunting around for a motive, all right, she and her husband had been estranged for a while. There'd been some discord of late. She invites her husband to lunch along with the other four. He decides not to come. So this, bizarrely, she then carries out her plan on the four other people, the supporting cast.
Yeah.
So we still don't know. And I don't know, you meet people in this life. Well, I do anyway. I met some very strange people, as you probably already guessed. But sometimes you can't work out why they committed the crime, because they don't think like us. It's just, you're an inconvenience. I'm annoyed with you. Whereas most of us, almost all of us, will think, well, killing someone is abhorrent. For some people that you bump into, it's not, they just don't consider it the way we consider it. It's a way to deal with the problem.
And when she's when she's giving evidence, when she's an adult, I mean, what's her demeanor like? Because again, is she emotional? Because that's the reason. Because some people want to be in the spotlight. And they can't distinguish between what's actually happening in real life and what they've read and seen on true crime. You must have seen this, Duncan, with young guys who think they're like Chopper, the famous Australian, and they think they're going to do a rap video, and the look on their faces when the judge says, 12 years, mate, off you go. And they're like, oh, well, hang on a second. I mean, is it the reality and fantasy thing you think going on?
I think in Erin's case, like others as well, I think she actually enjoys the limelight. There is sort of weird boost for her. She's a narcissist. She was an extremely competent witness. She was very good in the witness box. Not convincing, obviously, but she was very good. She turned the emotions on and off, and we saw that throughout her entire performance. The emotions were available to her when she wanted to flick the switch. But yeah, I often wondered in this case whether she's like the arsonist who joins the fire brigade so they can be part of the action. They move from being a fascinated onlooker, centre stage, and Erin's been centre stage on this now for 2 years. She's lodged appeals, so that centre stage will keep going for a little while longer. My psychologist mate tells me that the very heart of cases like this is this extraordinary narcissism. And again, a person who isn't mad, a person who is just bad. I know it sounds trite, but he said, you've got to understand, in crime cases, some people are not mad, they are just simply bad. They're wired differently.
How was the the jury? Presumably they were in a complete sort of media, take your phones off, you can't see anything influencing you, because that's one of the big problems, isn't it, with doing 21st century law and 21st century trials.
It's a good point you make, actually. We approach things differently. There were 12 jurors, 5 women, 7 men, as I recall, when it finished. One of the questions I asked them is what they'd read about the case, what they'd heard about the case. Had they been listening to podcasts, because there are all sorts of those kicking up. And rule of thumb, if you have showed an interest in the case, you're not going to be part of the jury. So they have to go in there with as clean a possible mind as possible, sit down and just decide purely on the facts they've heard in the courtroom, divorce everything else from it. So, and likewise, they're admonished not to talk about it with anyone else aside from their colleagues on the jury. One juror was turfed. I think we had a couple of, you always go into a courtroom with a couple of extra jurors for a long trial, a reserve. One of the original jurors was removed from the jury fairly early on because there was a suspicion that the juror might have been talking to someone else, possibly a family member, we don't know. So the judge makes sure that jury pool remains pristine from start to finish. There are no outside influences whatsoever. They purely decide on exactly what they've heard in the courtroom. And if you spend time in courtrooms, you see there's a bit of aerobic content in a courtroom as well, because quite often you'll get to a point and the jury will have to be set out. They have a cup of tea, pull it back in again. So quite a lot of action in a jury trial. But these people just they're in a country town. When they went away to consider their verdict, they were sequestered in a hotel. Mm-hmm. So there were no outside influences at all. And then they came back, 6 days odd later, I think, on a Monday morning. Because I'd been in and out of the trial for the entire duration. And I'd sort of scratching my head on the weekend thinking they'd been out for a couple of days. The judge is going to ask them a question as to how they're going. And in the jury, and sorry, in the media room that morning, so I've gone down to listen to it thinking, yeah, something's going to happen. And tapping a couple of other old hard heads there thinking, you know, we know that the case against her is sound, but will it fall into that grey area? Will it be proven beyond reasonable doubt? And we're thinking, oh, are we going to head to a mistrial or something along those lines? We're all having lunch and a cup of tea. All of a sudden, our phones go off in the local coffee shop. Toasted sandwiches dropped, coffee left to one side. We run back to the courtroom. At 2:15, the jury came back and said, guilty, 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 guilty. And that resolved any of our morning's discussions quite effectively.
So, I mean, here we go. Hollywood screenwriter, is there a, you know, around the court? Because, again, people, because thankfully, most people, yeah, unless you've been a cub journalist and spent far too many times in Crown Courts in the UK, you know, most people only thankfully get their idea for what happens in a case from Hollywood or from whatever soap you're watching, and they don't get the mind numbing people wandering in and wandering out, having a conversation, you know, the whole. So what, you know, was it the you know, drum roll, ladies and gentlemen, how do you find the et cetera moment?
No, it was this whole case wasn't terribly, there are a couple of moments of drama, but it's not like you see on TV. There's no sort of stunning moments where they stand up and they're waving papers and they're drama and raised voices. Courtrooms in Australia and the UK, and we've both been to lots of them, are always quite genteel. It moves along. It's very fair, very balanced. Raised voices are incredibly rare. The jury came back in and they just sat down. The foreperson stood up, formally asked what it was, and was literally over in about 20 seconds. Mm. They just read the charges out. The foreperson sits back down again. The entire courtroom was deadly silent. And I think for most of us, it was just relief that it was finally over, particularly for the poor families as well who've been involved from day one. And it's interesting, you watch these cases too, the toll from day one to the last day of the trial, everyone involved is looking so tired, so worn out. It's quite, you know, they're quite an epic trial when you go for about 10 or 11 weeks as this did. But that afternoon, it was all over very, very quickly, literally 15 to 20 seconds. And it was just this massive sigh almost in the courtroom.
And there's no screaming and crying and breaking down because this is the sort of person you're dealing with. And again, it is interesting because a lot of people would, again, the Hollywood thing is, no, but normally it's like, it's so banal, isn't it, Duncan, sometimes?
It is. And that's perfect, actually. It's relief for the people who've been involved. Erin Patterson sitting in the dock, nothing in the way of emotion shown. And curious enough, I've watched her during this through the sentencing procedures and the day the sentencing was dropped. Just no emotion at all. Maybe the occasional sort of tear when her kids were mentioned. Mm. But for the rest of it, the most awful crimes. And she was in court when the victims read out their impact statements or gave evidence about the impact on them. And I was literally sitting, 6 or 8 foot away from her. And just, again, nothing. Quite extraordinary. Ian Wilkinson, the guy who survived, gave the most extraordinary statement about his experiences from the floor of the courtroom. Very little out of Erin, just very cold.
Revisiting it, you know, writing this now, there's an appeal going on. I mean, an interesting one to you know, this is your 13th book, Duncan. I mean, how do you put a spin on it without being sensational? Because it'd be very easy. And, you know, we know because we've got it over here, you know, your killer wife, etc. But I mean, poison, you know, women who poison is a special subcategory, isn't it?
Yeah, I think with any crime case, I just like to take people into how it works. I mean, you've been doing it for a while. I'll give you the guided tour of the case, the courtroom, the investigation, that sort of thing. So people get a real idea of what's happening sort of behind the headlines. I mean, yes, you're right. There are lots of headlines about this case. But let's walk you through it, how it happened, the bizarre story that we could now tell after the case is over about how her husband had been, he thought he'd been poisoned by her on 3 or 4 separate occasions. The poor guy was hospitalised near death at one stage. And his power of attorney to ensure the life-saving surgery was his wife, Erin. So we could tell those stories as well, this bizarre lead up to it, something the jury couldn't hear. So we sort of go into it, sort of take you on a walk through the case, and now we've got the appeals coming up, so there might be just a little bit more to add to the story as it goes along. Both the Crown have appealed that she's got a, quote, manifestly inadequate sentence, which refers to the parole period. She got life
with how long for parole, though?
She got life with 33 years non-parole period. She's eligible for non-parole and, well, she'll be about 80, 81.
Yeah.
The Crown have appealed that because they don't think she should get any non-parole period whatsoever. I suspect the judge has based that non-parole on the fact that she's currently at a high-risk prisoner, not a risk to others, but she's at risk from other prisoners. Mm. So she's in a cell 22, 23 hours a day. The Crown have appealed that, and there in about two or three weeks ago dropped her appeal against her conviction, which goes over 7 points, which basically saying there's been a miscarriage of justice. This is sort of what you'd predict, and one of them struck me as being a little unusual in that she said that the Crown prosecutor was basically fairly nasty to her in cross-examination. Now, I've been cross-examined a few times. I thought the cross-examination was exactly what it should be, fair but rigorous. And a bit aggressive. That's what cross-examination's about. But I think Erin handled it really well. She was a very capable witness. Except no one believed her, of course, because she was a terrible liar. And it was lie after lie after lie she had to address, lies she told, that the prosecution had shown the court that she was just an absolute liar. And there's this long list of lies she told. And some of them are quite bizarre. And she... One of the reasons for the lunch was that she was going to, that she put forward was that she'd had a possible cancer diagnosis.
This is narcissistic behavior. This is, you know, it's all about me and, you know, I might not make it. So, you know.
This is, yeah, what should I tell the kids? And that's why these good people were there to help her along, not only to just have a family lunch, but to give her advice on how she should deal with it and the kids. Pretty cruel stuff. And then she backs down from that as the case progresses. And she said, well, I was a bit embarrassed. I was going in to have some gastric banding surgery. Well, that didn't go terribly well because the cops went to the clinic and found out they don't do it. So Erin's wonderful story, this fabric of lies that she'd woven, were very nicely picked apart by the prosecution. So she's in the witness box and she's got to address those lies. And she did her best, I think, but the jury didn't wear it.
What are you hoping that people are going to... It's a fascinating case, and it sort of harks back. I mean, is this just a bit of honest reporting, Duncan? And there aren't any lessons we can take from this, are there? Surely, I mean, you know, like the Americans, there's not a journey to go on here because it's just one of those banal, and they're always like this. And the thing is, we've got to remember the victims because we always remember the poison. Yeah. We don't remember the poor bloody, you know, family who just went there for being polite.
Yeah. Yeah, she sentenced this family to a very complicated future. She's got an ex-husband who's been poleaxed. She's got two kids who have had not only their grandparents murdered, but also close relatives murdered, and their mum is in jail. And she's the most, she's got to be one of the most infamous crime cases in the last 50-odd years around the world. No one's going to forget Erin Patterson in a hurry. So, yeah, and you're right. It's always, you've got to remember these poor souls that have gone through, the ones who were lost, and the ones who wake up every morning having to deal with their lives. And this is where Ian Wilkinson, the survivor, was so powerful in what he said. Just listening to what he'd gone through and what other family members had gone through, they have to live with this day in, day out. Now, the psychological, in his case, psychological and medical impacts as well. I mean, the bloke was in a coma for just on 2 months.
Yeah, awful stuff. The book, I could talk to you until probably another 3 hours, but unfortunately, we're about to crash the news, which will get me in all sorts of bad books. The book is called Recipe for Murder. Listeners, if you go onto our virtual bookstore, click on the front cover and it'll be winging its way to you. Duncan, if people want to find you online and say nice things to you, where can they find you?
All over social media, on Instagram, on X, just on Duncan McNabb, they'll find me very, very quickly, or through my publisher, which in the UK is Headline and Australia Hachette.
And what are you up to next? What's next in your crosshairs?
I have to. I'm looking around for another, but there's a couple of good outback mysteries in Australia, but there's also, I love a heist story, and I'm just the one at the Louvre the other day. Maybe a couple of heist stories, but I've... That story has hooked the world. I love it. So maybe something about heists.
Yeah, anything that involves sticking it to the French, I'm always, trust me, I'm a rugby boy. The book is called Recipe for Murder. It's by Duncan McNabb. Duncan, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Giles, thank you very much.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.